Tuning in. Good to see you. And of course, I can see you. If you're listening to this program, I can see you perfectly okay. You, sir, you should not listen to the radio in torn underwear. Crazy. That's the only word I can think of tonight. Crazy. Crazy. Aside from the fact that, we're all going to die from global warming, if you just sort of stay away from that for a moment, crazy. Political craziness. Have you heard, we're going to be all over the map tonight, by the way. We have a moment with Bob coming up here in about half an hour. Romney says, in a political ad, quote, under Obama's welfare plan, you wouldn't have to work and wouldn't have to train for a job. They just send you your welfare check, end quote. See, this is what it's come to. Romney knows that he has got to push all the buttons of the crazy people in this country. The next thing Romney is going to do is put on an ad that says, Barack Obama wants to force your child to become a Muslim. Barack Obama is going to make certain that your child has to go to a mosque for his education directly from the Quran. That's coming next. But today it was, under Obama's plan for welfare, you wouldn't have to work. And you wouldn't have to train for a job. They just send you your welfare check. Now, the ad opens thanks to Tampa Bay Times PolitiFact.com, Pulitzer Prize winner, run by the St. Pete Times. The Romney ad opens with a picture of former President Bill Clinton signing the 1996 Welfare Reform Act, which certainly hurt an awful lot of poor folks in this country. But keep in mind that Bill Clinton was a center-right Republican. He was not a Democrat by any stretch of the imagination. But the 96 Welfare Reform Act that he and Newt Gingrich and the right-wingers in the House and Senate worked out shifted welfare from government assistance to one based on steering people toward employment and self-reliance, whether there was jobs available or not. didn't make any difference. We're going to steer you towards jobs. What? There's no jobs? Darn. Well, hold on. Now, in the ad, after you see Clinton signing this Welfare Reform Act, the words unprecedented success flash on the screen. The narrator says, Clinton and a bipartisan Congress helped end welfare as we know it by requiring work for welfare. But on July 12th, President Obama quietly announced a plan to gut welfare reform by dropping work requirements. Under Obama's plan, you wouldn't have to work and wouldn't have to train for a job. They just send you your welfare check. And welfare to work goes back to being plain old welfare. Now, the July 12th announcement made by the Department of Health and Human Services HHS, allows states to try different ways of meeting the work requirements of the federal law. Does it really mean they just send you your welfare check? Well, PolitiFact decided to look a little bit further. Now, a little background. Since 1996, welfare has been administered through block grants to states through a program called TANF, Temporary Assistance to Needy Families. It limits how long families can get aid, requires recipients to eventually go to work. It also includes stringent reporting requirements for states to show that they are moving people off welfare and into the workforce, even if there are no jobs. But never mind about that. A memo from George Sheldon, who's the acting assistant secretary at HHS, said the department wanted to give states more flexibility in meeting those requirements. You know, states' rights, states, because the states, some of the states are suffering more critically than others, right? So states' rights, right? States' rights, states' rights. Oh, no. Not to these right-wingers who can't stand the black guy in the White House. The memo notifies states, quote, of the secretary's willingness to exercise her waiver authority to allow states to test alternative and innovative strategies, policies, and procedures that are designed to improve employment outcomes for needy families, end quote. The memo outlined, and this is where they get into the jargon of federal bureaucracy, but the memo outlined the kinds of waivers that would be considered. It suggested projects that, quote, improve collaboration with the workforce and or post-secondary education systems. It also has demonstrate strategies for more effectively serving individuals with disabilities. Those are two examples. Now, what does all that mean? Liz Schott, senior fellow at the left-leaning Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, translated it for us. It says, if you can do a better job connecting people to work, we would consider waiving certain parts of the performance measures and use alternate measures. Now, Schott, who studies welfare policy, said the TANF sets guidelines for what activities may count toward meeting the law's work requirements. You know, jobs, job training, internships, or schools, to name a few. Beyond that, it puts restrictions on how many hours a welfare client may spend at school, how many consecutive months they can attend before they act before that activity no longer counts toward the work requirement. See, in other words, the Clinton Act of 1996 brings a hammer down on people. I mean, you have such a narrow little crawl space to operate inside or within that if you make one mistake, if you go past one deadline, that's it. You're cut off. Forever! So Liz Schott, the senior fellow at the Center for Budget and Policy Priorities, said, as a result, states are running less effective programs than they might be because they're so driven by performance measurements as it's set forth in the federal law. Do you understand this? You can only have so much time in school, only so much time in job training, only so much time here, so much time there. And then if you, you know, the person who's unemployed, poor, welfare recipient, TANF, whatever you want to call it these days, if you are not meeting the requirements, they kick your ass to the curb. This is the great Bill Clinton liberal, we're going to get people off welfare act. Yeah, we're going to get them off welfare and put them in the goddamn street. Anyway, these waivers then that Health and Human Services came up with would allow for some flexibility. For example, someone with a special needs child might require different work arrangements than are currently allowed. Or a person who needs to improve his or her English skills might need more time to take classes. Liz Schott said, quote, it's really about the underlying program. The real starting place is what's the most effective program to get this person to work, end quote. Now, shouldn't that, I mean, that's the way it should be, right? Is the goal to get people to work, or is the goal to beat and punish and kick to the curb and be mean and hateful and right-wing to people who can't defend themselves? Oh, that's an easy question, truth seekers. In a memo released along with the ad, the Romney campaign says the change, quote, undermines the very premise of welfare reform It is an insult to Americans on welfare who are looking for an opportunity to build better lives for themselves. It's a kick in the gut to the millions of hardworking middle-class taxpayers struggling in today's economy, working more or less, more for less, but always preferring self-sufficiency to a government handout. What? Where? But, I mean, where did that last come from? A kick in the gut to be... States' rights! States' rights! States' rights, you sick sons of bitches! States' rights! Isn't that what you've always screamed about? Well, there's a little more here. Stick around.
Radio Right. From the left, it's Mike Malone.
21 past the hour. So the topic at hand is this charge by Mitt Romney in another one of these filthy, obscene political television ads that under Obama's plan for welfare, you wouldn't have to work, you wouldn't have to train for a job. They just send you a welfare check. Tampa Bay Times, PolitiFact.com, a Pulitzer Prize-winning site, has taken apart what Romney said in this ad. Romney is just, I mean, this guy is a real loose cannon. I mean, he's starting to scare me for this reason, on the possibility that his operating team is able to steal the election. To have this kind of a madman in control, I would have felt better with Barry Goldwater, I think, than this guy. Not only is he the stupidest son of a bitch that has ever run for president, bar none, he makes Bush, the younger, look like he had, I don't know, at least a high school education. Not only is Romney the stupidest man ever to run, but he's the most manipulable, and he's the biggest liar. I mean, it's one thing. Our political system is so corrupted, and you know this as well as I do, that it's just full of different shades of bullcrap. But to come right out like this, this is what you expect from the teabag freaks in their little local elections back in Arizona or Michigan or Georgia. Sick man, I swear to God. Anyway, the ad says... Or the memo that was released by the Romney brown shirts along with the ad says the change that Health and Human Services is proposing underlies the very premise of welfare reform. But, of course, it does nothing of the sort. It allows the states in a time of extreme financial stress to make some changes to maybe help people get to work. To maybe ease some of the restrictions. God, I hate these people. The right-wingers. The memo says that Obama, quote, hopes states will consider approaches that remove work participation rate requirements altogether, end quote. And as PolitiFact points out, the HH letter contains nothing of the sort. In several places, it says only proposals from states that improve, quote, improve employment outcomes, end quote, will be considered. Improve employment outcomes. So the Romney cadre has taken this because they understand who's going to vote for them. They understand the idiocy of this so-called independent voters. That's who Obama and Romney are going after, the independent voter, the 30% of the electorate in this country that hasn't made up its mind. Are you goddamn crazy? Sigh. The Romney campaign also contends that Health and Human Services Secretary Kathleen Sebelius is not legally allowed to waive the existing work requirements. Robert Rector, a welfare expert with the Conservative Heritage Foundation, argues that the part of the law allowing waivers does not cover TANF work provisions. In a July 27th column in the National Review, the right-wing National Review, he wrote, quote, critically, this section, as well as most other TANF requirements, is deliberately not listed. Its provisions cannot be waived, end quote. Now, as PolitiFact says, that might be a point, but it's one that the courts will have to settle. Romney's ad says, under Obama's plan for welfare, you wouldn't have to work and wouldn't have to train for a job. They just send you your welfare check. That is a complete lie and a total distortion. They just send you your welfare check. PolitiFact concludes, the ad's claim is not accurate, and it inflames old resentments about able-bodied adults sitting around collecting public assistance. We call pants on fire. Oh, well, that's kind of cute, but I call goddamn liar. That's what I call goddamn liar. But, you know. Now, a little more on this when we come back. We have a moment with Bob that kind of, sort of, possibly ties into all this. So, I hope you'll stick around. Yeah, I'm probably going to be cussing a lot. Oh, and we have a moment, not a moment, but we have a missive from Prairie, too, tonight also. So, stick around. You do know that they put a lander on Mars, right? I'm Mike Malloy.
He lies and he lies and he lies. He lies and he lies and he lies. He must despise all the what fors and whys. The way he lies and he lies and he lies. And he lies, he just lies, and he lies, and he lies, and he lies. He can lie any time, he can lie any place. He crosses his fingers and keeps a straight face. He lies, and he lies, and he lies. Too many believe him, they're bleating like sheep. Accomplices now in the liar's deceit. He lies, and he lies, and he lies.
Welcome back, 25 before the hour. Okay, the first half hour, we had a bad power glitch here in the foothills of North Georgia Mountains. We're back live on Wednesday, August 8th. Sorry about that. Where this studio is out of nowhere. I know, we should have a generator. I understand that. And perhaps someday we'll be able to afford to buy one. In the meantime, you want to give us one? I get these emails. I count on church night. Where are you? You let me down. No. I do not let the audience down. The only time you will not hear this program is if, A, at the last minute I get vomitously sick, or B, there is a power outage. So ease up a little bit, folks. I mean, we don't just decide, oh, I don't think I'll do the program tonight. This hour is being sponsored by Chris in New York. Sorry, Chris, I'll squeeze you in a little bit more since we only have a chance to mention you twice. And Chris's message, this is a reminder to all Truth Seekers to sign up for a podcast subscription and sponsor an hour of the program. Yeah, please do that. Maybe someday we can buy a generator. No, we live in a not, you know, we're in the Atlanta area, but we live out in the country. So, anyway, we're back live. Listen, what I wanted to start with tonight, at Huffington Post today and at the L.A. Times, Boston Globe over the past few years, and a couple other publications. Are you aware? I was not aware of the connection between Bain Capital, Mitt Romney's company, and the Central American death squads. No, seriously. I mean, this is not something that you get at one of these crazed conspiracy websites. This is real stuff. And I want to share some of this with you because I just wonder if anyone will ask this rat bastard about the history of Bain. In 1983, Ryan Grimm and Cole Stangler at Huffington Post put this together. But in 1983, Bill Bain, yeah, there was a guy named Bain, Bain Capital, asked Mitt Romney to launch Bain Capital, which was to be a private equity offshoot of the consulting firm Bain and Company. There was some reluctance at the beginning, and then Romney agreed. The new job came with a stipulation. Romney couldn't raise money from any current clients, Bill Bain said, because if the private equity venture failed, he didn't want it taking the consulting firm down with it. So this is going to be something separate from Bill Bain's already established company. So Romney struggled to raise funds from other traditional sources. He and wasn't being very successful. So he and his partners started thinking outside the box, way outside the box. Bain executive Harry Strachan suggested that Romney meet with a group of Central American oligarchs who were looking for new investment vehicles because turmoil was engulfing the region. I'm sure you remember the 80s in Central America. Not just Nicaragua, but Honduras, Guatemala, El Salvador, the 70s and 80s. It was a goddamn bloodbath down there, thanks to the CIA and the capitalists and the oligarchs in the United States and in Central America. Well, anyway, the oligarchs were worried about where to put my money, So they were looking around for investment outside of Central America. In steps Mitt Romney. Romney was worried at the beginning that the oligarchs might be tied to illegal drug money or right-wing death squads or left-wing terrorism, right? That's what Strachan told a Boston Globe reporter, as quoted in the 2012 book, the book out this year, The Real Romney. But he was pressed for capital, so Mitt Romney pushed his concerns aside and went to Miami in mid-1984 to meet with the Salvadorans at a local bank. According to the L.A. Times, it was a lucrative trip. Central Americans provided roughly $9 million, 40% of Bain Capital's initial outside funding, and the Salvadorans became valued clients. Strachan, now remember who he is. Strachan is the... Strachan is the guy, or Bain executive, Harry Strachan, said in his memoir in 2008, quote, over the years, these Latin American friends have loyally rolled over investments in succeeding funds, actively participated in Bain Capital's investor meetings, and are still today one of the largest investor groups in Bain Capital, end quote. Now, when Romney launched another venture that needed funding, his first presidential campaign, he returned to Miami. He said at a dinner in Miami in 2007, quote, I owe a great deal to Americans of Latin American descent. When I was starting my business, I came to Miami to find partners that would believe in me and that would finance my enterprise. My partners were Ricardo Poma, Miguel Dueñas, Pancho Soler, Frank Kardonsky, and Diego Ribodeniera. Romney also could have thanked investors from two other wealthy and powerful Central American clans, the De Sola and Salaverria families, who the Los Angeles Times and the Boston Globe have reported were also founding investors in Bain Capital. De Sola and Salaverria, these two families. Now, while they were on the lookout for investments in the United States, members of some of these prominent families, including Salaverria, Poma, De Sola, and Dueñas clans were also at the time financing death squads in El Salvador. The ruling classes were deploying the death squads to beat back left-wing guerrillas and reformers during El Salvador's civil war. You remember any of this? I mean, you're going to have to be, you know, around 50 years old or 40 anyway to remember this. You don't learn this in school. But we're talking about hundreds of thousands of people were butchered in Central America, backed by the CIA. The murder was backed by the Reagan administration, the Carter administration, the Nixon administration. I mean, it just never stopped. It was just blood all over the place, death and destruction in order to protect U.S. capitalist interests. Anyway, I digressed. The death squads committed atrocities on such a mass scale for so small a country that their killing spree sparked international condemnation. From 1979 to 1992, some 75,000 people were killed in the Salvadoran Civil War, according to the United Nations. In 1982, 2 years before Romney began raising money from the oligarchs, El Salvador's Independent Human Rights Commission reported that of the 35,000 civilians killed, most died at the hands of death squads. This just goes on and on. When the Huffington Post asked the Romney campaign about Bain Capital accepting funds from these families tied to death squads, a spokeswoman forwarded to Huffington Post a 1999 Salt Lake City Tribune, or I'm sorry, Salt Lake Tribune article to explain the Romney campaign's position on the matter. She declined to comment further. The Tribune wrote this, quote, "Romney confirms Bain had investors in El Salvador, but as was Bain's policy with any big investor, they had the families checked out as diligently as possible. They uncovered no unsavory links to drugs or other criminal activity," end quote. Now, as Huffington Post says, nobody with a basic understanding of the region's history could believe that assertion. And here's why. By 1984, the media had thoroughly exposed connections between the death squads and the Salvadoran oligarchy, including the families that invested with Romney. The sitting U.S. ambassador to El Salvador charged that several families, including at least one that invested with Bain, were living in Miami and directly funding death squads. Even by 1981, El Salvador's elite, largely relocated to Miami, were so angered by the public perception that they were financing death squads that they reached out to the media to make their case. The two men put forward to represent the oligarchs were both from families that would invest in Bain 3 years later. The most cursory review of their backgrounds would have turned up the ties to the death squads. The connection between the families involved with Bain's founding and those who financed death squads was made by the Boston Globe in 1994 and the Salt Lake Tribune in 1999. This election cycle, Salon first raised the issue in January, and the Los Angeles Times filled out more of the record earlier this month. This month being August. Now, as Huffington Post says, there is no shortage of unsavory links. Unsavory? I thought savory meant something that tasted good. But anyway, even the Salt Lake Tribune article referred to by the Romney campaign reports that, quote, about $6.5 million of $37 million that established the company came from wealthy El Salvadoran families linked to right-wing death squads. You see where I'm going with this? Do you understand what this bloody son of a bitch, this cult member, this bishop of the Mormon church, do you understand what's going on here? Does any of this matter to you? There's more, but if you don't want to hear it, send me an email and say, ah, screw it, we don't want to hear it. We'll be right back.
to bed angry. Let Mike do it for you. It's Mike Malloy.
10 before the hour, and this hour is being sponsored by Chris in New York. His message, this is a reminder to all Truth Seekers to sign up for a podcast subscription and sponsor an hour of the program. Thanks, Chris. We're talking about information that is in the public record about Mitt Romney and Bain Capital and the death squads in Central America during the 80s when Bain Capital was put together. Now, I know a lot of people don't give a rat's ass. You know, it doesn't make any difference. But it makes a difference to me, and I think it should make a difference to people who are going to vote for him. Now, I realize what I just said. The people who are going to vote for him also couldn't give a rat's ass. They don't care. Death squad, schmeth squad. I mean, who was killed? A bunch of goddamn peasants. Who cares? They're probably communists anyway, right? This is the way right-wingers think. If their government tells them that there are left-wing terror organizations operating in El Salvador or Guatemala or Honduras or Nicaragua, these asses will believe it. These right-wing Americans will believe, oh, yeah, well, sure, of course, yeah, they're commies, yeah, that's right. Mm-mm. So, revealing Bain Capital's connection and Mitt Romney's connection to people who have committed mass murder, up to and including the execution of nuns, the Archbishop Archbishop Romero, Oscar Romero, the Archbishop of San Salvador, they don't give a goddamn. Right-wingers don't care. They don't care how many people die. They're about death. Not theirs, of course, but somebody else's. So I realize once again, I'm talking to the choir here. Preaching, well, it is a church night. We're preaching to the choir. But you need to know that this filthy son of a bitch, Mitt Romney, was involved with people who not just financed his company, but financed death squads all over Central America in order to protect capitalist interests. Now, let me get back to what Huffington Post had today. The Salavaria family, whose fortune came from producing cotton and coffee, had deep connections to the right-wing Nationalist Republican Alliance. That's ARENA. Remember that. ARENA. That's the acronym. ARENA. A party that death squad leader Roberto d'Aubuisson, and to those of you who were conscious during the 80s, the name Roberto d'Aubuisson will really ring a bell. This guy was drenched in blood. He was a right-wing hitman. He controlled death squads all over Central America, but especially in El Salvador. The ARENA. Death squad leader Roberto d'Aubuisson founded in the fall of 1981, the year before El Salvador's government had pushed through land reforms and nationalized the coffee trade, moves that threatened a ruling class whose financial and political dominance was built in large part on growing coffee. See, El Salvador tried, like so many Central American or Latin American countries tried to do, to take back from the oligarchs. And the oligarchs had gotten to these positions of power thanks to the United States Marines. Go read Smedley Butler. God damn it. Go read War is a Racket. You right-wingers cannot continue to exist in your sphere of total ignorance. For Christ's sake, educate yourselves. Try to understand what's going on. I'm screaming again. ARENA controlled and directed death squads during its early years. On March 24, 1980, Oscar Romero, Archbishop of San Salvador, and an advocate of the poor, was celebrating mass at a chapel in a small hospital when his brains were blown out on d'Aubuisson's orders. That's according to a person involved in the murder who came forward later. The day before, Romero, Archbishop Romero, an immensely popular figure, had called on the country's soldiers to refuse the government's orders to kill fellow Salvadorans. In his sermon, Romero said, quote, "Before another killing order is given, the law of God must prevail. Thou shalt not kill," end quote. Next day, d'Aubuisson had him assassinated in a chapel, the back of his head blown off. This is where Mitt Romney gets his money, or got his money. For God's sake, do you not care? Of course you don't. Of course you don't. In 1984, Robert White, former U.S. ambassador to El Salvador, named two Salaverria brothers, Julio and Juan Ricardo, as two of six Salvadoran exiles in Miami who had directly funded death squads, repeating in sworn congressional testimony a claim he'd made earlier as ambassador. The group became known as the Miami Six. Ambassador White testified that a source close to the Miami Six had notified the U.S. Embassy of their activities in January 1981. Now, when was Romney down there sucking around looking for money? 1983. Ambassador White was pushed out of his job by the incoming Reagan administration in 1981 because he was considered insufficiently supportive of the Salvadoran ruling class, the death squads, the people that the Reagan administration decided to align themselves with, right? Oh, by the way, D'Aubuisson endorsed Reagan in 1984. Of course he did! Of course he did. When contacted by phone recently, former Ambassador White reiterated his claim about the Salaverria brothers. He said he couldn't reveal his source's identity in order to protect the source. Ambassador White told the Huffington Post, quote, "The Salaverria family were very well known as backers of D'Aubuisson. These guys were big money contributors. They were total backers of D'Aubuisson and the extremist solution, including death squads." Now, there's more of this, and I'm going to continue to share this with you from Huffington Post today because it matters. The hour. We're talking about Mitt Romney's direct connections with mass killers in Central America, the direct connection of money flowing from these oligarchs into Bain Capital when Mitt Romney was given a chance to assist in putting the company together back in the early 80s. Romney may be a dumbass. He may also be a very ignorant man. What did he say today? He's talking about referring to the Sikh religion as sheikhs. He may be the stupidest person ever to run. But to have knowingly associated, and if he claims he didn't know anything about it, he is a filthy liar. Of course, Romney lies all the time. His religion allows him to lie, if it is to further the goals of the church. God only knows what the goals of the Mormon church are with Romney as president. So the man is a total liar, which is bad enough. But his association with these death squads is something that should disqualify him from even citizenship, shouldn't it? I mean... Let me go on. This is in Huffington Post, Boston Globe, L.A. Times. Francisco de Sola and his cousin, Herbert Arturo de Sola, also invested early in Bain, according to the Los Angeles Times. Two other members of the de Sola family were limited partners, according to the Boston Globe. But the Romney campaign declined to provide the Huffington Post with these other members of the de Sola family's names. The de Sola family was one of El Salvador's most powerful coffee growers and financiers of the Arena Party. Now, remember, the Arena Party was a party put together to run death squads, put together by Roberto d'Aubuisson back in the early 80s. Herbert's brother, Herbert Arturo de Sola, an early investor in Bain. His brother was the notorious Orlando de Sola, who resisted the peace negotiations toward the end of the Civil War. The Romney campaign acknowledges Orlando de Sola's connection to death squads, but insists he is not representative of the de Sola family investors. Well, Romney told the Salt Lake Tribune in 1999 that the backgrounds of the families had been checked diligently. He had explained to the Boston Globe in 1994 that Bain's due diligence included only the backgrounds of the individual investors, not their family members. Romney said at the time, quote, "We investigated the individual's integrity and looked for any obvious signs of illegal activity and problems in their background and found none." Deflecting the association with Orlando de Sola, Strachan, whom Romney had charged with vetting the investors. Remember, he was one of the early people with Bain. Strachan described him, Orlando de Sola, that same year to the Boston Globe as, quote, "the black sheep of the family." He was kicked out of the family business, end quote. Yet there is strong evidence that Orlando was anything but a black sheep in the de Sola family. Indeed, he was a leading public face of the Salvadoran elites in Miami, speaking, for example, on behalf of the El Salvador Freedom Foundation. That's the organization which arranged a U.S. press conference for d'Aubuisson as part of its public relations activities on behalf of the oligarchs and Arena, the political party put together to murder thousands of people. An Associated Press story from April 1981 includes Orlando de Sola and Alfonso Salavaria speaking on behalf of the oligarchs in exile. The story also makes reference to Ambassador White's charges regarding the funding of death squads, indicating that the charges were already well known by that point. But the ties run deeper still. In 1990, Orlando de Sola, d'Aubuisson, and founding Bain investor Francisco de Sola allegedly assassinated two activists then in Guatemala, according to a report by that country's government, which cited its intelligence sources. The activists had just held a meeting with then-Senator Chris Dodd, Democrat of Connecticut, who was attempting to broker a Salvadoran peace deal. Francisco de Sola later pleaded his and his cousin Orlando's innocence to the U.S. ambassador. The Inter-American Commission on Human Rights looked further into the killings and concluded that elements of the Salvadoran right were indeed the most likely assassins, but said it couldn't confirm the guilt of the de Solas or d'Aubuisson. It deemed the investigation incomplete and called for a deeper look, which never occurred. The three men were never charged. Francisco de Sola is now president of the Salvadoran Foundation for Economic and Social Development. His assistant, Ada Chang, said he was traveling and unavailable for comment, but she confirmed to Huffington Post that he had been accused of murdering the two leftists in 1990. Whether he committed the crime or not, the fact that Guatemalan intelligence would associate him with Orlando de Sola and d'Aubuisson and place them all in Guatemala together cast further doubt on Strachan's claim that Orlando de Sola was merely a black sheep who'd been kicked out of the family business. All right, that's enough. I mean, you can go to Huffington Post and read it yourself if you want to. But, dear, you know, and some of the more bloody stuff comes further into the story. For example, as Romney now seeks support from the Latino community in his campaign for president, his knowledge of Bain's all-too-few degrees of separation from Salvadoran death squads may become a topic of interest. Arturo Vizquerra, an immigration lawyer who, like many other Salvadorans, immigrated to the United States in order to escape the bloodshed, said, quote, under Ronald Reagan, the U.S. sent billions of dollars to the murderous regime, which utilized that aid to fund the military and death squads in an effort to preserve the unjust privileges of the Salvadoran oligarchy. To learn that a man, he went on, that may become president of the United States deserves some of his success due to the incredible inequality that the U.S. helped to preserve in El Salvador is ironic. It's morbidly funny, Vizquerra said. You know, I'll tell you what. Somebody could come up with pictures of Mitt Romney having sex with the devil, and it wouldn't stop these right-wingers. It just wouldn't. I'm talking about the American right-wingers. They don't care. Anything to get the black man out of the office, you know, out of the presidency. This hour is being sponsored by Serious Tax Reform. Mark at SeriousTaxReform.com. His message: the publication of Fishman's Framework for Tax Reform heralds the introduction of the tax reform plan that saves our middle class. It does so by requiring everyone to pay their fair share of the tax burden. When everyone pays their fair share, we can lower taxes while raising almost $1 trillion more per year in additional tax revenue. When the additional revenue is combined with the reprioritization of our budget expenditures, we solve Social Security's long-term funding problem, create and fully fund national health care, and expand public education to allow all academically qualified students the opportunity to attend college or vocational school free of charge. Along the way, it creates millions of high-paying jobs and solves each state's fiscal crisis. This reform plan will be accepted by a majority of Americans because it is written from the perspective of and meets the objectives of Republicans, Democrats, and Independents. Fishman's Framework for Tax Reform is available to read free of charge at SeriousTaxReform.com.
You know life, robbing living people. Whoa, Lord, for a good many years. Sound like to me I can hear this morning, people. This bell ringing all in my ear.
Sound you're hungry and phone, baby, crying.
Progressive Talk. It's Mike Malloy.
Twenty-one past the hour. Got an email from Edie in Atlanta regarding past couple of days, Romney has really, really come out of his crawl space with some of the most off-the-wall garbage about Obama wants to do away with all the requirements signed into law by Bill Clinton regarding welfare reform. And according to Romney, what Obama wants to do is tell people, you don't have to work, you don't have to be trained, just vote for me, all you black folks. And when I get reelected, you all will get your welfare checks free. This is a kind of racist drivel that this crazy son of a bitch is putting out there now, Romney. Edie writes, Bill Clinton signing, Mike, I remember vividly Bill Clinton signing the Kick Helpless Women and Children to the Curb bill, and how he looked up after signing it with a dung-eating grin on his face. He looked as if he was thinking, do you like me now? The right wing appreciated his gifts to them. NAFTA, the FCC rulings, so much that they rode him all the way to impeachment. Like Obama, Clinton could have been great, and all it would have taken was doing what they knew was right. Instead, their legacies, both, are marred by cowardice, scandal, and weak wills. For sure. For sure. This is from Jet Fixer. I love his handle. July was the hottest month on record in the continental United States, continuing the warmest January to July period since modern day record keeping began in 1895. NOAA, National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, reported today. The average temperature for July across the continental U.S. was 3.3 degrees Fahrenheit above the 20th century average. The last four 12-month periods have each successively established new records for the warmest period of that length. In the 12-month span from August 2011 to this past last month, July 2012, every state observed warmer than average temperatures except Washington State, which was near average. And record-setting drought continues to plague 63% of the 48 contiguous states, according to NOAA's Drought Monitor, with near-record drought conditions in the Midwest. And still, the deniers continue. That's what drives me crazy. And how they're able to intimidate the Democratic Party leadership and the President of the United States into not taking any action at all. We talked last night about what's coming up for Louisiana school children. The religious superstition and lies that they're going to be fed thanks to new laws in that state. And now this. One Louisiana school is dealing with that state's high rates of teen pregnancy by taking kind of a different approach. No pregnant students are welcome at Delhi Charter School in Delhi, Louisiana, a policy that this school enforces by requiring students who are suspected of being pregnant to submit to a mandatory pregnancy test. If the test is positive, the girl is no longer allowed to attend classes on the school's campus and will be forced to either switch to another school or begin a homeschool program. If a student refuses to take the pregnancy test, she is treated as a pregnant student and kicked out of the charter school. What was it, The Handmaid's Tale? I haven't read that Atwood book yet, Margaret Atwood's book, The Handmaid's Tale, but
Do you folks understand? Not you right wingers. You don't give a rat's ass about this stuff. But normal people, do you get that? You will take a pregnancy test, 16-year-old girl. And if you're pregnant, you're out of here. And if you refuse to take the test, you're considered pregnant. Before the hour. So, charter school in Louisiana's new policy, if they suspect that one of their students is pregnant, they will demand that the girl take a test, pregnancy test. If she is pregnant, she is forced out. If she refuses to take the test, she is considered pregnant and forced out. Now, it doesn't say anything in the handbook about the boy. Because regardless of what these sick sons of bitches really believe, there's no such thing as immaculate conception. If a girl becomes pregnant, it's because some boy put his penis inside of her and ejaculated. Now, what are they going to do with the boy at the school, the Delhi Charter School in Delhi, Louisiana? What it says in their student handbook: if an administrator or teacher suspects a student is pregnant, a parent conference will be held. The school reserves the right to require any female student to take a pregnancy test. Isn't that a little redundant, you halfwits? To confirm whether or not the suspected student is in fact pregnant. The school further reserves the right to refer the suspected student to a physician of its choice. If the test indicates that the student is pregnant, the student will not be permitted to attend classes. Now, the ACLU points out that this group of morons at Delhi Charter School has their policy, their discriminatory policy for pregnant students is, quote, in blatant violation of federal law and the U.S. Constitution, end quote. On Monday, the ACLU of Louisiana and the ACLU Women's Rights Project sent a letter to the school asking it to suspend its policy on the grounds that the new Delhi Charter School's unfair treatment of its pregnant students violates the following laws: Title IX of the Education Amendments of 1972 for excluding students from educational programs based on sex, the Equal Protection Clause of the U.S. Constitution for treating female students differently from their male peers, as well as stereotyping suspected pregnant students on the basis of their gender. The Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment that recognizes a right to procreate, as well as a right to decide whether to terminate a pregnancy, for targeting students in a way that appears to stigmatize pregnancy. My God. So, to you sick sons of bitches at this sick school, no reference to the boy who ejaculated inside the girl to get her pregnant. Any consequences for the boy? Or is it just the bitches that you have to control? Is that what it is? These damn women! Even when they're 13 and 14 and 15, they're out there in the weeds doing it. You sick bastards. Sick bastards. It just keeps getting worse and worse and worse, doesn't it? Huh? Doesn't it? This hour is being sponsored by Sirius Tax Reform. Mark at SiriusTaxReform.com. In fact, it was Mark, not the company, that's... Mark's message. The publication of Fishman's Framework for Tax Reform heralds the introduction of the tax reform plan that saves our middle class. It does so by requiring everyone to pay their fair share of the tax burden. And when everyone does that, we can lower taxes while raising almost $1,000 billion more per year in additional tax revenue. When this $1 trillion is combined with the reprioritization of our budget expenditures, we solve Social Security's long-term funding problem. We create and fully fund the national health care, and we expand public education to allow all academically qualified students the opportunity to attend college or vocational school free of charge. And along the way, millions of high-paying jobs will be created, and each state's fiscal crisis will be solved. This reform plan will be accepted by a majority of Americans because it is written from the perspective of and meets the objectives of Republicans, Democrats, and Independents. Fishman's Framework for Tax Reform is available to read free of charge at SiriusTaxReform.com. Thank you, Mark. A letter from Robert, addressed to me, and I guess more than just to me. But here's what Robert says. I think if I hear one more time that Obama signed the NDAA, I'm going to puke. NDAA, Patriot Act, trespass laws, Gitmo, and all language concerning the rights of Americans past and present were concocted for all the wrong reasons and probably wrote by some fascist think tank and then passed in Congress, the vast majority being Republicans who approved. Yet no one ever, or rarely even, mentions this fact. People want to hold Obama's feet to the fire because he signed a bill that 83 out of 100 U.S. senators passed. And if I'm not mistaken, that's veto-proof. They only needed 66 votes, or is it 67? But who's counting when you have 83? People actually believe if an American citizen was arrested and whisked away, never to be seen again by the National Guard or the U.S. Army in the streets, it would be President Obama's fault. He signed NDAA. That he hates Americans. It was his plot from the beginning. He wasn't even born here. He's really a Muslim. Chuckle, chuckle. I hate him. I'll never vote for him. And on and on and on. Sometimes I wonder if all those senators and House members signed this NDAA simply because the NDAA appropriated over $650 billion, much of which would go to states of our Congress members to be spent to keep people employed. Maybe these Congress members thought detention language would be overlooked. After all, the $650 billion would go to military contractors that... I don't know. This gets kind of confusing here. The point is, if you want to fix America, you have to first fix Congress. And before you can fix Congress, the people of this nation need to understand who exactly has authority and responsibility to write laws and legislation on literally everything right or wrong, past or present, that govern this nation. That would be Congress. So before any of you say Obama signed NDAA, please read this again. And even more important, please stop blaming Obama for what a totally dysfunctional Congress has been doing to this nation for decades. Instead of saying Obama wants to arrest Americans, say instead Senator McCain and the Senate Armed Forces Committee not only wrote but attached this unconstitutional law to a defense spending bill and also voted for it along with 80-something other senators, making NDAA law. Or say, if I find out my representative or senator is allowing the president to start wars without congressional approval, I will no longer vote for that individual. Or say, I'm sick and disgusted Congress has authorized yet another $650 billion for defense spending when we have teachers being laid off all over the country. And this must stop immediately. Or say, we have some very serious problems when Congress refuses to do anything about the Supreme Court's decision that now considers corporations people. And they can now secretly invest unlimited money to buy our legislators. And the same majority in Congress don't even want voters to know just who is doing the buying. It's not Obama. Signed, Robert. Well, I certainly get what you're saying, Robert, but if the president signs a bill, it doesn't become law until the president signs it. And as far as vetoing it and then have the veto overridden, well, that's what the Constitution allows. The Constitution doesn't say that the president should pee his pants and run and hide and whip out his pen and sign a piece of fascist legislation because 85 half-witted senators sponsored it. I'm sorry, Robert, but I think you have it asked backwards, my friend. It is Obama's fault. It is up to Obama. We have, or used to have, the idea of checks and balances. And the veto pen was one of those checks. So, I guess we'll just leave it there.
Seated to rub ya, wrong way, hate to hate to love ya. Sad day, can't win a debate with dub ya. Especially when the company cap is Kenny Lane. Meanwhile, sweatshops paying pennies a day. Big bank take little bank anyways. Why the country's over going to war for many days. John Bush playing Family Feud with the time. Survey said, oops, you out of time. We the only ones allowed to have nuclear bombs. Guaranteed it won't be.
To Mike Malloy. Turn down your speakers. It'll be our secret.
I don't care if it rains or freezes, long as I got my plastic Jesus riding on the dashboard on my car.
10 before the hour, you want to hear something really crazy. Well, let me do this one more time. This hour has been sponsored by Mark at SiriusTaxReform.com. And here's his message. The publication of Fishman's Framework for Tax Reform heralds the introduction of the tax reform plan that saves our middle class. It does so by requiring everyone pay their fair share of the tax burden. When everyone does pay their fair share, we can lower taxes while raising almost $1 trillion more per year in additional tax revenue. When the additional revenue is combined with a reprioritization of our budget expenditures, we solve Social Security's long-term funding problem. We create and fully fund a national health care, and we expand public education to allow all academically qualified students the opportunity to attend college or vocational school free of charge. Along the way, the tax plan creates millions of high-paying jobs and solves each state's fiscal crisis. This reform plan will be accepted by a majority of Americans. Fishman's Framework for Tax Reform is available to read free of charge at SiriusTaxReform.com. Check that one out, True Seekers. I haven't done it yet, but damn sure will. This story is just beyond belief. in eastern PA, outside of Philly, an Occupy protester is now facing a charge of attempted bank robbery following an arrest at an Occupy-organized event at a bank, during which the occupier, Dave Grzynski, was holding a sign that reportedly read, "You're being robbed." He had another sign that said, "Give a man a gun, he can rob a bank. Give a man a bank, and he can rob the country." He's been arrested for attempted bank robbery because he held a sign? What kind of a half-ass cop would walk up to somebody who's holding signs like that and arrest them and charge them with attempted bank robbery? What do you boys use for brains? You boys in blue, what is your problem? Oh, we know the answer to that. Occupy Easton PA reports on their Facebook page that Grzynski, quote, was at the bank protesting the theft of our tax dollars, our homes, and our economy by the criminal banksters, end quote. Grzynski allegedly did the same thing a short time later inside of Bank of America. First was Wells Fargo, then Bank of America, prompting an employee to activate the panic alarm. Police reportedly responded, located Grzynski with the signs in question. He was sitting on his ass outside and arrested him. The Occupy Easton group posted, quote, "He's not a criminal. If the police were truly there to protect and serve the taxpayers, the banksters would be arrested, and this man would be called a hero." And the police chief of Easton, yeah, here we go, told the Easton Times the investigating officers were acting appropriately. The chief said, quote, "I think our guys did what they had to do in this instance. At the end of the day, if we get a report of a panic alarm at a bank, we're going to respond accordingly." You know, if somebody's dog goes in the bank and the person's making a deposit and the dog urinates on something and there's a short and the alarm goes off, well, we're going to arrest somebody, maybe the dog. But somebody will get arrested. Oh, my God. According to Occupy Easton, Dave Grzynski now faces two felony charges, including attempted bank robbery and terroristic threatening, and one misdemeanor charge of disorderly conduct. Originally, he was held on $10,000 bond. He has been released with the help of donations. Calls to the Easton Police Department by CBS Philly have not been returned. Thanks to Susan for sending that one to me. Can you believe that? Charging him with bank robbery because he held a sign? Charging him with terroristic threats because he said, "Give a man a bank, or give a man a gun, he can rob a bank. Give a man a bank, he can rob a country." See, this is part of the Homeland Security, Obama administration determination to protect the banksters at all costs. This is an Obama administration policy. This has to do with a law passed by a fascist Congress and signed, or a bill passed by a fascist Congress and signed into law by a Democratic president? Are you kidding me? No, I guess you're not. All right, we'll take a break, and when we come back, if you'd like to call in and comment on some of the fun and frivolity that we're having tonight, you may do so. The number is 877-996-2556. We may do church night tomorrow night. I just got so freaked out by what I read at Huffington Post today. I didn't know the LA Times or the Boston Globe or the Salt Lake Tribune or all these different publications had had been pulling out little bits and pieces of information about Mitt Romney and Bain Capital and death squads in Central America. I had no idea. Thanks, deep thanks to the Huffington Post for publishing what they published today. We'll be right back. From Steve in New York in response to what Robert had written about, it's not Obama's fault. It's not Obama's fault about, for example, the National Defense Authorization Act that included the right to, was it that or the reauthorization of the Patriot Act, whichever one included the right to effectively do away with the Fifth Amendment. And also the granting to the chief executive the right to extrajudicially target and assassinate American citizens. And Robert's point was it's not Obama's fault. 85 senators had signed on to this, and that's veto-proof and all this other stuff. Well, Stephen York writes two things. One, I get sick of the excuses of the so-called veto-proof NDAA vote. The point, that person who wrote to you and all the so-called liberals who give Obama a pass, the point is they always gloss over is that if Obama had shown some courage and vetoed NDAA and dared the Congress to overturn it, who knows what would have happened? And two, really a corollary to number one, is that too often Obama doesn't even try. Exactly. Absolutely exactly. So, Steve in New York, his subject line, it is Obama's fault. I totally agree with that. I've heard the argument before that Robert made that, what are you going to do? You're only the president. That's essentially what the argument was. What are you going to do? Obama's only the president. I mean, he only has so much power. Yeah, well, too bad he doesn't exercise that power in a manner that would show that he is willing to be a leader. This is one thing that I've come to realize about Barack Obama over the past almost 4 years. He's not a leader. He doesn't want to be a leader. He doesn't act like a leader. He doesn't lead like a leader. He's a classic go-along-to-get-along type. And he governs from the right when he does govern. He's a great speaker. He can certainly put those sentences together. He can get me on my feet cheering. Well, not literally. But he's just simply not a leader. When you're in a shark pool, which is what this Congress has become, the whole country has become. You know, if you're going to try to play go along, get along, you're going to be eaten alive. And he's being eaten alive. I mean, they have so little respect for this man, they being these filthy Republicans, they have so little respect for him or the American public that Mitt Romney can put ads on the air that are absolute lies. And nobody, with the exception of PolitiFact, will stand up on their hind legs and label it a lie. They use weasel words. Oh, it's an untruth. Well, what are some of the other words they use instead of saying lie? It's a fabrication. It's a misrepresentation of facts. It's none of that. This is a goddamn lie. And why doesn't Obama call it that? He can leave out the goddamn, but why doesn't he just stand and look in the camera and say, this freak on the right is lying? Just like the Republicans lied about death panels. No, he's not a leader. I'm sorry. He's not a leader. And the veto pen is, I think that's what was referred to when the statement, the pen is mightier than the sword, was first made. Okay, I'm just kidding. But the veto pen, especially when a part of a bill or an amendment, whatever the NDAA was, when it was added to the defense Defense Authorization Act, it was a bill in and of itself. But those parts of it that allowed a complete abrogation of the U.S. Constitution. And we're to believe that this constitutional scholar, Barack Obama, was so unable to lead that he signed off on that, and that somehow that's not his fault? Well, then whose fault is it? Whatever. Sam is in Huntington, West Virginia, listening on XM. Hello, Sam.
Hey, I totally agree with you, Mike. Obama, I like to call him Captain Cave-In. You know,
Captain Cave-In?
Yeah, I mean, the guy will cave, you know. And you know, I understand ninth grade civics. I understand it takes a two-thirds majority of the Senate to overturn a veto. But history's going to judge you, man. History will judge you. You have basically said that you're willing to unleash the U.S. military on American citizens. And, you know, American citizens can be locked away with no trial, no anything. They can just be locked away.
Mm-hmm.
You know, dude, that's wrong. Now, I mean, yeah, they would have overturned it, and I have no doubt that Republicans, they would have had a great time, you know, rubbing his face in the fact, hey, we screw your veto. We chumped you again. But he could have gone back to his voters. He could have gone back to his base, and he could have said, for the entirety of history, this is wrong. I want to know part to do with it. Yeah, they passed it anyway. They overruled my veto, but I disagree with it. But
yeah, and let the historical record show that this president tried to stop this wild ass swing towards fascism, and he was defeated by Republicans. I mean, wouldn't that be better for the man's legacy to show that he tried to stop it rather than that he signed off on it? I mean, what is he thinking about? This is a part I don't get.
I'll tell you exactly what he's thinking about. He's thinking about his lack of a spine, his lack of a pair. I mean, you got to understand, I mean, nobody ever heard the name Joe Wilson, but Obama and the Democratic Party, let's not give all of them a pass, they allowed this man to stand before the world and call him a liar. Nothing was done.
Right.
Nobody said anything about it. We can't forget all the racist crap that's been thrown at the man. Idiot from Colorado called the man a tar baby.
Mm-hmm.
The list goes on and on and on, and there's never any pushback. There's nothing. You can do and say anything about this man.
he won't stand up and defend himself. So what makes you think he's going to stand up and defend you?
Well, that's the thing. I mean, it would just seem to me, I realize that there are rules that everybody's supposed to play by, but those rules are made out of mush and crap, and everybody knows it. But, you know, here's a guy who was elected president. And just like you point out, the slobbering sons of bitches that put these insults on him. And rather, you know, I mean, what would you do? I'll tell you what I would do, Sam. I would grab the, you know, when somebody said something like that, I would grab that State of the Union message when that punk said, you lie or whatever. Why didn't Obama just turn towards him and take the microphone and call his ass out and just say, you cracker son of a, well, he couldn't say that, but just call him out and just say, what do you mean? Stand up, sir. What do you mean I lie? What are you talking about? Tell me what the lie is. And just come down on him like a ton of bricks. Hold on a minute. That's the part that bothers me about this president. Just like Sam points out. He's had some stuff said about him, his wife, his children, and he just lets it roll off rather than just grabbing one of these sons of bitches by the shirt lapels and punching his ass out. What are they going to do? They can't arrest him. He's the president.
Every time I turn on the TV, somebody's acting crazy.
End your day screaming with Mike Malloy.
Anyone past the hour, where'd Sam go? Sam in, where is he, West Virginia? All right, well, maybe he had to go. Ricky is in Decatur, Georgia, listening online. Hey, Ricky.
How you doing, Michael?
I'm all right.
I'm fine, too.
Okay.
Well, good for you, too, Mike. Say, Mike. I mean, why is it that you have some of these radical right-wing radio talk show hosts such as Dana Loesch criticizing negative ads about Mitt Romney, yet praising and supporting negative ads about President Barack Obama?
Well, because they're, you know, the Republicans will do anything to remove Barack Obama from office. I mean, you don't expect Republicans to be anything but hypocrites. Hey, don't breathe in the phone like that, Ricky. It's blowing out our transistors.
Okay.
You don't expect Republicans to have any sense of fairness or to be anything other than hypocrites, do you?
No.
Okay. Well, that's the answer to your question.
No.
They're just, they're slime. I mean, you know.
Yeah. And like you said, Mike, he's kissing these people's asses instead of standing up to these people. The president is. Instead of kissing their asses, why don't you kick their asses? You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Well, I certainly agree. Ricky, thanks. I appreciate you checking in. It's too bad that the president doesn't get some advice along those lines, and perhaps he has, to kick ass and take names rather than to just stand there and let these fools run over him like this. That's something. I mean, look, I think we all know that politicians will lie. And it's got to the point where, what's the so-called approval rating of Congress now? 16%, 11%, 8%, something? I don't even know what it is. But when you get to the point where you can constantly accuse the President of the United States as being not an American or not a citizen or an agent of a foreign government, or use a certain religion and then associate the president with that religion as though that, you know, that makes him, evil. I mean, it's gotten to the point where it's beyond insane. I mean, I don't know. I don't know where we've landed. But I do know who put us here. People like Beck and Limbaugh and Hannity and Coulter and all these swine that for years now have been doing this, just absolutely destroying and corrupting. And every single one of them has become filthy rich from doing that. Absolutely mega wealthy from destroying the country that they're just treating like they're a vampire. They just sink their fangs into this country and they're just sucking everything out of it. And I don't know. I don't know. It's too much for me. Derek is in New Mexico listening on Sirius. Hello, Derek.
Hey, I'll up you one.
Okay.
The bill first went through the Senate with the language of the American citizen. And then I complained to our congressman down here, Steve Pierce, Republican, and I said, man, I said, you guys need to make sure that this thing doesn't pass. He says, don't worry about it. We're excluding the American citizen language before it goes to the president. So they sent the bill from Congress that excluded American citizens as part of the National Defense Appropriations Act, which didn't make it necessarily right. And then Obama went ahead and said, I will not sign this unless you put the language back in.
How do you know that to be true?
That's what I've read.
Okay, but where? I mean, I guess what I'm saying is, what's the source? I'm not challenging the truth of it. I'm just asking you, what's your source? Because anybody can say anything. And, I can tell you that Obama really said, if you don't put that back in, I'm going to kill my children. And you'd say, what? What's your source? So, you know, you.
Well, when I called Steve Pierce's office, they said that they were going to exclude that language.
Okay, but how do you know that they did?
I don't know 100% for sure, but that's what I've heard.
Well,
That's basically, I pretty much feel that is true.
Well, it may be, and I'm not disputing the truth of it. I'm just asking you, you know, what the source is. If it were a reliable, a usually reliable source, like, I hate to say this, but like the Washington Post, New York Times, NBC, it would be a little bit easier to accept that it was Obama who put that back in.
Let's check it out.
All right, do that and call me back.
Okay.
Thanks, Derek. I appreciate you checking in.
I am a patriot. That's safe in a land that's clean and free for every color and culture, every person, every belief. Your greed, your fear, and your lies ain't gonna push me around. I'm gonna use the power I have. I'm gonna vote you right out of that house.
Standing up to the flying monkey right, it's Mike Malloy.
My promises are snapped in two, words are meant to bend.
Five before the hour. Back to your calls. Tim is in Detroit. Hey, Tim.
Hey, Mike. Yeah, the first time I had heard about the NDAA was back in December of 2011. I heard Sybil Edmonds on a talk show.
Mm-hmm.
And to paraphrase what she was saying that the NDAA was the Patriot Act, the 2008 FISA bill, and indefinite detention all rolled into one. And it seems to me that, you know, and I've heard this excuse before, that while Congress may have, you know, overridden President Obama's veto, if he would have vetoed the NDAA,
mm-hmm.
we don't know what his veto, what kind of impact it might have had. For example, if he had used the bully pulpit to say, look, this is clearly unconstitutional, I'm not going to sign it, and I want you, the American people, to hold every congressperson accountable for what they're going to do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't think it's necessarily guaranteed that the veto would have been overridden. You know, for example, with the Star Treaty that was passed, as weak as it was,
right.
a lot of Republicans opposed that bill, and President Obama really wanted that bill passed, and they did get even a few of those Republican, I can't swear on the radio, so the Republican blankety blanks
mm-hmm.
to sign onto the bill, and the Star Treaty did get ratified in the U.S. Senate. So. And I've noticed, too, with Barack Obama, whatever he wants to get passed quite often will get passed. You know, for example, the Health Care Act did get passed despite Republican opposition. And he's also passed this horrible free trade agreement with South Korea. So, you know, I don't think President Obama is necessarily as weak as a lot of people think he is. Now, I have to couple that fact, of course, with the incredible opposition on the right against him. So we have this incredible far-right force in this country,
mm-hmm.
the Republican Party and corporations, coupled with a president that quite often is willing to go along with them. So we're lurching towards fascism even with a Democratic president.
Yeah, it seems like it's more than lurching. It seems like it's, you know, a steady pace. Well, all right. Tim, thanks. I appreciate what you had to say, okay?
Sure.
All right, take care. Regarding what Tim just said and the caller from, was it Santa Fe? Where was it from? Where was the call from, Kathy, where the caller said that Obama had insisted on the language going back in? This is from RT.com. From December 12th, 2011, kind of what Tim was just talking about. This is what it says. The Obama administration has insisted that the president will veto the National Defense Authorization Act for fiscal year 2012. A bill that passed through the Senate last week. Under the legislation, the United States is deemed a battlefield. An American suspected of committing a terrorism offense can be held without trial and tortured indefinitely, despite the grave consequences for citizens and the direct assault on the U.S. Constitution. The act managed to make it through both halves of Congress, but President Obama says he won't let it become law. However, according to Senator Carl Levin, Americans should be a bit more concerned about what the president's actual intentions are. Levin, who sits on the Armed Services Committee as chairman, the Senate Armed Services Committee, has revealed to Congress that the Obama administration influenced the wording of the act and shot down text that would have saved American citizens from the indefinite imprisonment and suspension of habeas corpus. Senator Levin told Congress recently that under the original wording of the NDAA, American citizens were excluded from the provision that allowed for detention. Once Obama's officials saw the text, though, says Levin, quote, the administration asked us to remove the language which says that U.S. citizens and lawful residents would not be subject to this section. So that would make U.S. citizens and lawful residents subject. Specifically, the section that Obama asked to be reworded was section blah, 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 which says that, quote, any person who has committed a belligerent act, end quote, could be held indefinitely. Levin said, quote, it was the administration that asked us to remove the very language which we had in the bill, which passed the committee. We removed it at the request of the administration. It was the administration which asked us to remove the very language, the absence of which is now objected to. John Wood of Change.org writes that Obama proposed a veto of Section 1032 of the NDAA, which does not pertain to the detention of American citizens. Rather, that section deals with the use of the U.S. military in taking custody of suspected criminals. Okay, so this was written back in December, and the promise was that, according to this, that Obama would veto it, which he did not. I mean, Jay Cruzen writes, hey, it's worth mentioning that Chris Hedges' lawsuit has neutered the NDAA indefinite detention clause for now anyway. Well, that's right. There is that lawsuit that's been filed, and I guess the as it works its way through court, the law can't be enforced. Is that it? It would just seem to me that the simplest way to have handled it is what a couple of the callers have suggested tonight, and that is Obama should have just vetoed the bill. And if the Senate wanted to override the veto, go for it. And the president could have pointed out to the American public what was going on, but apparently he chose not to do that. It makes me very, very nervous that I have people who listen to this program who are not right-wingers who believe that somehow Obama was duped into signing this NDAA, or that that Obama, for whatever reason, refused to use the power of the veto, and now the folks who are defending Obama say, well, what do you expect? 85 senators voted for it. But that doesn't mean anything, except that 85 senators voted for it. That's what it means. That's all it means. It doesn't have anything to do with what would happen if the president decided to veto something. It simply means that 85, or whatever the number was, 85 senators did vote to pass this bill. Okay, once that happens, then it's out of the hands of the legislative branch, assuming that the House had signed off on it too. Okay, so then it goes to the executive branch. Whole new ball game. The executive branch can then go ahead and either sign it or not sign it. If the executive branch signs it into law, then it can make its way to the third branch of government, the Supreme Court, eventually, or the federal court system, to decide whether or not the law is constitutional. So it just seems that you know, going back to what the racist, genocidal framers of this country tried to set up, where it concerned white folk, white males, with their checks and balances, that people now, including the Democrats or liberals, are expecting that somehow Obama can't use the very power vested in the executive branch to stop this craziness. And therefore, he's not to be held responsible for the fact that it passed. The fact that he signed it, well, it's, you know, my pen signed it, but it's not my fault. I am the president. I'm the CEO of the United States, but it's not my fault. I am a distinct third branch of government. And I have as much temporary power as any of the other two branches where it concerns legislation. But it's not my fault. I mean, that. I'm sorry. No, I'm not going for that at all. Not at all. We'll be right back.
Hey, a traveler on an airline, had his name on a secret list. He was taking away with his laptop, and as he left, he called out to me.
GK in Minnesota, under the subject line, "Would Jesus Go to a Bar?" Hi, Mike. I'm probably one of the few people that listen to your show that can't wait until Sunday morning rolls around. What to do on Sunday morning besides go to the local church and confess sins that may have built up in oneself through the week if the urge to suppress them was not possible? Or to listen to the preacher give a rousing recital of hope, faith, and goodwill toward your fellow man? Then again, it could be the camaraderie one shares with fellow churchgoers while partaking in a spirited religious discussion over a cup of Java and a donut in the fireside room. But Mike, none of those are any reason whatsoever why I look forward to Sunday mornings rolling around, not even close. No, Mike, I look forward to those mornings because I can take my two labs out for a walk and not have to worry about all those speeding, cell phone talking, stop sign light blowing, cigarette butt flicking motorists whizzing down the roads, making my walk a little precarious while crossing the roads. I do. No, by the time I arrive, all the church goers are tucked away in the pews listening to the so-called Word of God and reaching into their pockets for their tithings, I think you meant, the church expects from them. Also, the people that visit the clubs the night before are too tucked away in their beds sleeping off their hangovers, all the while probably subconsciously saying to themselves, "I will not drink anymore," and that they will attend church next week. But when it's all said and done, they don't. That's why I like Sunday mornings. Okay. It is church night. We didn't really get to church night. Maybe we'll do some of it tomorrow. I don't know. Bryant is in Chicago listening on XM. Hi, Bryant.
How you doing, Mike?
I'm all right. And how are you?
I'm good. I just wanted to talk about, you had, were talking earlier about Obama and, you know, why didn't he, like, stand up, you know, when he was given the the speech, you know, the guy yelled, "You lied," and everything. I mean, we've seen disrespect and hatred that is unprecedented for this president. Anywhere from, you know, him yelling, "You lied," to the lady that, you know, stopped him on the tarmac and pointed their finger at him. You know, we've seen disrespect that's unprecedented.
Mm-hmm.
If he, you know, reacted the way we wanted him to, or we think that, you know, he could, my crazy theory, they would kill him. He can't govern the way we want him to. He does things that are so Republican, but they still get upset. It doesn't matter what he does. Even with the health care bill, Mitt Romney has the same thing in Massachusetts, and they hate it.
But, well, all right, well, then let me ask you the obvious question, and I'm not trying to be a smartass here by any means, but knowing this, why then did he run for president? Did he honestly believe that these this racist society would accept him?
I don't think he thought, you know, that he would be, I don't know. I just think that he just can't go as far as what we want him to.
Is it because he's biracial that he thought he might have a chance?
No. That doesn't matter to the right. It doesn't matter.
Well, I know, but I'm talking about him. Did he think, maybe? I mean, I'm just trying to figure out if Barack Obama understood, and I'm sure he did, about racism in this country and how not just virulent it is, but how dangerous it is. If he understood that, then, and if he understood from that, he was able to extrapolate and say, well, if I become president, I'm going to get nothing but crap from not just from the House and the Senate, but from people out in the world. Then why did he run? Unless he thought that he might be exempt because he had a black parent and a white parent. I mean, I don't know. I'm trying to figure out what he thought.
No, I don't think he thought that, you know, he would be exempt. I thought, you know, just like any first black person that does anything, you know, all the way from Jackie Robinson, he knew there was going to be hatred and stuff coming, you know, at him. But he went, you know, he had to do what he had to do. There's just the way Barack is governing. I just don't think he is able to go as far as what he wants to or do the things that he wants to. Because just the hatred, the pure hatred for this man is just, it's like nobody has ever seen before.
Well, no, I completely agree with you regarding the hatred and the disrespect that's not being shown, that is being shown not just to Obama, but to the office of the presidency. I mean, the disrespect that's out there right now is horrendous. I didn't think that this country was capable of going into that kind of a slime pit, but here we are. So then it raises the question again for me, then why would Obama want another 4 years, A, B, after his policies were so so defeated during the off-year election in 2010, why didn't he just step out and say, okay, you people have spoken, I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to govern the way I want to govern because I know that your attitude is so bad, you just took away from me any power to do anything. So here's what I'm going to do. I mean, I don't get that. I don't get any of it. I don't know why Bryant, a man who understands and is the object of this hatred, would want to continue. Do you? Where'd Bryant go? Bryant! Something happened. We lost Bryant. All right. Well, we're out of time anyway. Bryant, I'm glad you called. I'm sorry that we lost your call. Sorry about the problem. Well, I can't say I'm sorry. Something was struck by lightning not far from here during the first half hour of the program tonight. Thanks to the tech people at Dial Global who were able to keep things going for us until the power came back on. We do appreciate that. I'll see you tomorrow night. All right? Take care. Keep it lit. I'm Mike Malloy.